I'm Marty Moscowen. Welcome to Radio Times. Chen Guangcheng, the blind dissident who had sought refuge in the American embassy in Beijing, is now in the United States with his family. His daring escape from house arrest in late April caught the world by surprise and threatened to damage U.S.-China relations. But through quiet diplomacy, Chen and his family were booked on a flight out of China and arrived in New York on Saturday. James Fallows knows a lot about China and about aviation. His new book, China Airborne, is about his love of flying and about China's airport boom. He writes that two-thirds of all the airports being built today are being built in China. James Fallows is a national correspondent for The Atlantic, an instrument-rated private pilot, and appears regularly on NPR's weekend All Things Considered. And James Fallows, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Marty, it's a pleasure to talk with you. Thanks very much. And I'm eager to discuss the news and the background, too.
Well, let's start with the news. What's the significance of Chen's arrival in the United States?
I think there are several aspects. First, obviously, it's good for him and his immediate family. His wife and children came with him, and they're in a better situation than they've been for 7 or 8 years. There still are a lot of his supporters and his more removed relatives who are back in China, and more significantly, back in this small village in Shandong province where they've been mistreated by local officials. So it's good for his immediate family. It probably is good for U.S.-China relations, too, because a month ago, you'll recall that this seemed like it was going to be a major head-on imbroglio between the U.S. and China, and I think each country found a way to finesse that and avoid it and to get Mr. Chen and his family away. It's worth realizing that from the crassest point of view of the Chinese government, they're better off with him out of the country than in the country, because the track record of dissidents is that once they leave China, their influence within China inevitably dwindles. One other point to make is that it's, for those of us in the press, it's a worthwhile sort of cautionary note about instant conclusions about things, particularly in China, because for the first day or two, all the coverage was, oh, the U.S. had mishandled these negotiations, et cetera, et cetera. And in fact, there was a sort of deeper game going on than was evident on the surface.
Telling us something about the kind of quiet diplomacy that can take place behind closed doors?
Yes, and also the fact that in dealing with the Chinese government in particular, it's rarely the case that what is in the superficial out front display is rarely what matters most. I was thinking of an example now 2.5, almost 3 years ago, when President Obama made his first trip to China in the fall of 2009. And the U.S. press coverage with the sort of traveling party was relentlessly sort of mocking of how humiliated he was. He wasn't criticizing the Chinese leaders to their face, and America was appearing as the sort of indigent supplicant for Chinese aid. And in fact, it appears that Obama was able during that trip to sort of make a lot of longer term deals that turned to the U.S. advantage with China. So that's my press commentary portion of the program.
Fair enough, but we might pick up on that. But help us understand who Mr. Chen he still exists, but why he was under house arrest in China.
He's very significant as a different kind of Chinese dissident than the ones we're used to thinking of in the U.S. Or the U.S. conception of dissidents, either in the old Soviet Empire back in the days of Solzhenitsyn or Sakharov, or the Vaclav Havel type of dissidents from the Eastern European countries, these were often highly educated people. They were intellectuals who were appealing to an international audience for some different post-communist regime. And a number of the most famous and prominent Chinese dissidents who've come in the now 20-plus years since Tiananmen have been in that category. Chen Guangcheng had a whole different standing in China because he was a different sort of person. He's from a very humble sort of background. He's been blind from very early in his life because of a disease. He calls himself a self-educated lawyer. You know, he has been able to learn some fashion of the law himself. And significantly, the main argument he's made inside China has been not for getting rid of communist control, not for opening up some new democratic system of selecting leaders, but rather for holding the communist government to its own announced standards. For example, there are not supposed to be these late forced abortions on women in his province, and he's been protesting against that. He's been defending farmers whose land has been seized or whose crops have been destroyed by pollution. So there is a particular kind of appeal that he has to average Chinese people because he's one of them on their behalf, not some intellectual from, you know, Cambridge or Oxford or something. And he's, in a way, his argument is more threatening than some others to the communist establishment because he's saying, I believe in your ideals, and why aren't you upholding them?
And how well known has he been in China?
It's always so hard to tell that because the official Chinese press suppresses a lot of the news of these people who are celebrated in the outside world. And just in the last day or two, there was a very dismissive editorial in one of the main government papers saying, oh, here's another tempest in a teapot of one of these Western darlings who has finally left the country. So I think he was less well-known in China generally than he's become in the West in the last month, but probably better known in China before that than he was in the West before that, because not many people who weren't China hands had heard of him before then. So I think he has a modest sort of blogosphere and civil activist following in China, bearing in mind the main news media would ignore him altogether.
Well, and you and I don't know the details of his daring escape, but the fact that he could escape house arrest, be blind, obviously he had to have had help in order to get himself to the U.S. Embassy.
Yes, and there have been a variety of accounts of exactly. So the place where he was being held in a little village in Shandong was several hundred miles away from Beijing. It was in northern China, but not the same area as Beijing. And a significant fact is that the central government, you know, the equivalent of our national government, didn't have any legal charges against him. This was almost exclusively just oppression from the local, the provincial and village officials who were mad at him for various reasons and his family. So they were just having him in house arrest beyond any kind of color of the law. So he must have had people in his village in Shandong who were helping him get away. He must have had people who were going to drive him to Beijing. And then there's some flux in the accounts of how he actually got into the U.S. embassy. It's worth remembering that Western embassies in China and other other authoritarian countries, there's a fine line they have to draw because they can't just open themselves to anybody who wants to come in off the street. Otherwise, they'd have thousands of people per day. But so Mr. Chun, even though he is certainly well known to U.S. officials, the special circumstances of his being able to get into the embassy probably involved the fact that he was injured. You know, he had hurt his foot when, again, as a blind man, he was walking to escape from his jailing. So we don't know all the details. It will be a great novel or report at some point, but that's probably why the U.S. decided to help bring him into the embassy.
You had mentioned the fact that he has supporters, probably relatives left behind in China. Do you think they are at risk from what you know about China?
One would assume so, and again, largely because of this local versus provincial issue. I was seeing a report last night about one of his relatives who is now under some kind of charge, either a formal charge or an informal charge, for attempted manslaughter or attempted murder for fighting off some security guards. Wow. in his own house as part of this arrest. So I'm not attesting to the exact details of that, but one would assume that people in his extended family are in some difficulty now, and that's why it's worth keeping international attention on this case, even as inevitably Mr. Chun is going to descend in U.S. attention as he is no longer a sort of a dramatic refugee holed up in an embassy, but he's another non-English-speaking person at New York University. So I think it's very important to keep as much of a spotlight as possible on those who are still there.
But does it also tell us something about rural China, which maybe doesn't get the attention that a Beijing, for instance, would get?
It does, and it does even more than rural China, about China as an entity. I think one of the big themes over the last 6 years I've tried to convey about China, and I do it in this book, I do it in my articles, is how diverse a place it is and how difficult it is to say, well, China is X or China is Y, because even more than the United States, conditions vary from place to place and economic situation to economic situation. So it tells us, I think there is a generality about China that's illustrated by the fact that cases like this embarrass local officials, they embarrass national officials, and they're the people who are left behind are in some jeopardy. And then that varies. I think that the national government has little outright interest in persecuting these people because it's just bad PR for them, but the local people, local authorities may do it, and it's just going to be a hard road for them ahead.
Here's a kind of a broad-based question, but how would you then describe the relationship between China and the United States?
I think the remarkable thing about this relationship in the now 30-plus years since Jimmy Carter, who, for disclosure, I was working for during his administration, and Deng Xiaoping, normalized relations, is that it has been a consistent blend of contradictory elements, by which I mean both China and the United States have resolved, as of sort of the mid-1970s onward, that it was better for each of them to have this other large country as a potential partner rather than as a certain enemy. It would be better not to have a new Cold War or hot war between the U.S. and China, and that there are ways in which China's emergence economically and other ways could be supported by the U.S. and seen by the U.S. as a good thing rather than as a threat. But the final element of this mix, the U.S. and China still really disagree on a variety of important measures, from international strategic ones to domestic political ones to you name it. And so the intellectually and politically and just humanly interesting nature of the interaction between these countries over the 30 years is how all those things are true at the same time. On the one hand, you see very, very deep and friendly connections between hundreds of thousands of Chinese people who are in the U.S. and Americans who are in China and institutions and all that. I describe in my book how the only way in which Chinese air travel became something other than grossly dangerous was officials from Boeing and the FAA devoting themselves to making travel safer there. On the other hand, there are these genuine issues of disagreement. So it's been a long-term contradictory balance that both countries have tried to keep from getting any worse than that.
And we're almost up at a break here, and I do want to talk in more detail about your book after the break, but how much the fact that China owns or that the U.S. owes a lot of our debt to China, does that complicate our relationship even on top of what you just said?
It complicates it, but not in the way most Americans think. You recall some of the famous campaign ads about our paymasters in Beijing and all that. The relevant things to bear in mind are, number one, China is still much poorer than the United States. The average income there is still about one-seventh what it is in the U.S., so it is basically a poor country that has been sort of over-saving and exporting its savings in the form of this foreign debt. Number two, this, as the Chinese officials well realize, is a sort of mutual dependence relationship. We owe them, but many of their assets are here, so each is very subject to the other's goodwill and potential disruption.
Well, let's take that short break. We'll get back to our conversation. James Fallow is our guest today on Radio Times, and we'll be talking more about China and more about his new book called China Airborne. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
The Philadelphia Foundation supports WHYY. The Philadelphia Foundation manages 140 scholarship funds serving students throughout southeastern Pennsylvania. Individuals, companies, and educational institutions can set up a customized permanent scholarship fund through the foundation and receive tax benefits while helping students achieve their dreams. The foundation makes it easy by taking care of paperwork and accounting. The Philadelphia Foundation, 215-563-6417 or philafound.org.
I'm Marty Moscowain.
I'm Terry Gross.
And I'm Dave Davies. Help WHYY celebrate 25 years of Radio Times and Fresh Air at a special live event.
Dave will ask the questions. Marty and I will have to answer them at the Suzanne Roberts Theater in Philadelphia.
It all happens Monday, June 4th at 7, and you can reserve your tickets at whyy.org/member experience.
Celebrate 25 years of public media's best, Radio Times and Fresh Air.
Arcadia University supports WHYY and supports great teachers and education leaders. This summer, classes are available to start earning your certification, certificate, master's, or doctorate. Arcadia offers summer graduate education classes online at King of Prussia or Glenside. The world needs great teachers. Arcadia University summer programs. Class is now forming. Registration at arcadia.edu/masterofeducation. Arcadia supports WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoane talking with James Fallows. He's a national correspondent for The Atlantic, lived for a couple of years with his family in China, and he's written a new book called China Airborne. Excuse me, and we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Jim, you say that two-thirds of all the world's airports are under construction in China, and I'm trying to just, absorb, the level of construction that's taking place in China.
The level is very high, and so that the story I'm really trying to tell here is that is whether China is going to be able to make the next step in its development, and I'll explain what the background. You know, for 30 years, we've been familiar with this apparent miracle coming out of China, where it really has been miraculous in historical sense, where hundreds of millions of people have gone from rural poverty to this urban industrial life, which has pluses and minuses, but it is putting them on a better economic footing. But now there are many people in China who are worried that that model is reaching its limits, and the country, they don't want China just to become a sort of bigger and bigger version of the same thing. So there's this huge push towards advanced industries, pharmaceuticals, infotech, and aerospace, which is one of their big activities. And now, I don't know when anybody in America has seen a new airport being built. There may be one or so. There are about 100 major airports being constructed in China now, which is unprecedented in human history and is part of the big push they're putting towards the skies.
Well, I want to pick up on all of that, but I'm curious about when you go to an airport in China, does it look like an airport in the United States?
It looks like a way better airport because they're all so new, and they have a kind of surreal range. The one in the new one in Beijing was built as a real kind of national monument before the Olympic Games, and was very elegantly styled by a famous British designer. Because pollution is so bad in China, it already looks somewhat aged, but it is visually striking. You go to some little towns where there is not much air traffic, but you'll find a huge new airport, and they assume it will fill up. The main thing about this part of China's infrastructure, like many other parts, is that it's new compared to ours. If you go on Chinese airline flights, it's all relatively new, Boeings and Airbuses. The flight crews are relatively recently hired young people, and there's no embarrassment about hiring them for their youth and attractiveness there, so that's a whole different effect, too.
And who are the passengers?
Passengers are China's business hordes. I mean, in the U.S., in the 10-plus years since 9/11, commercial air travel has been more or less stagnant. It's gone up some, but not that much. In China, it's more than doubled in that time. It's gone up, double-digit amounts every single year without stop. So it's business people, it's travelers, it's families, it's migrants. The country has a huge unsatisfied need for transport of all kinds, by trains, by roads, by railroads, and by airports. So it's an all-fronts infrastructure boom happening at once.
Are there concerns that this boom could bust?
Yes, and I think that everything about the transition China's going through now, which is the what I'm trying to portray in this book, the way things have been kept going over the past 5 years, say, when the rest of the world has coped with this economic slowdown, has been just to open the spigots full force for infrastructure construction. That's why we have these 100 airports. That's why we have all these new cities being built out of nowhere. And that construction is ahead of short-term, market rational, normal demand. And so if this were a purely market economy, these things would be collapsing now. The challenge or the question on the Chinese side is the government has so many more means to avoid an implosion that it probably is not going to collapse the way we saw in 2008 with the real estate collapse. But the somewhat different parallel fear is that this is not going to make them rich unless they can also find ways to foster inside China industries like Boeing or like Google or like GE or like Siemens. Your listeners might, if your listeners try to think of one famous corporate brand name from the entirety of China, I predict they'll either come up with Qingdao Beer or some big state-owned enterprise like Sinopec or something like that, which are not really corporations in the form of a GE or Siemens. So there is a fear that both that it might bust and that it might not lead them in the direction they're hoping the economy will go.
You also say that China relies on exports in order to help it keeping its economy going. Thinking about the problems in Europe, U.S., of course, struggling with our own economy here. That's got to have some kind of impact on China.
It certainly does. And this is one more part of this transition. You can think, if you think of the last 30 years of China as being essentially the Industrial Revolution of Europe and the United States being compressed from like two centuries into 30 years, what's ahead of them now is something like the mid-20th century being compressed, they hope, into a couple of years, because the reliance on exports has created tremendous sources of new jobs for China, but it has two problems that are not always evident from our perspective in the U.S., but are very evident there. One is it means that most of the work that Chinese people are doing is not for their own consumption. Let me explain this for a second. You know, the U.S. is often concerned that its national savings rate is 1% or 4% or 0%. In China, the national savings rate has been 50%, which
50.
Is 50, which means not that each household is saving half its money, but that the entire nation's economy is consuming only half of what it produces. And the rest is either exported, you know, to us in Walmart, or it's invested in new infrastructure in China. And that is not sustainable when people are still so poor there. And second, it's not sustainable for the reason you say, that in the long run, the rest of the world can't just keep buying the stuff at the same rate. So I think the economic managers there realize this has to change, and the question is, can they change it?
And how serious is graft and corruption in China?
This is an intriguing question, as you would imagine, especially in the basis of the other big recent Chinese scandal, the Bo Xilai case in Chongqing. The simplest way to put it is I had assumed until fairly recently that the corruption within China stayed within the range of efficient corruption, like in Japan or Korea, where lots of people were getting rich in sort of difficult-to-explain ways, but the entire system kept charging ahead, as opposed to the really paralyzing corruption of some narco state, or Russia even now. There's increasing worry or questioning about whether that threshold is being crossed, whether the number of billionaires who are being created largely by government contracts, whether this is, number one, distorting the creation of real industries, and number two, sort of setting an example of how the country is running that is so disturbing to the rest of the people that it may be crossing a threshold. So it's not corrupt on the little level that you would see in some countries where you have to pay bribes for everything. It's a sort of higher level thing, mainly of government officials.
And is that why this Bo Xilai case is so important and worth watching?
Yes, this case, and I'll give the 20-second sum up, and
it's
then
complicated.
The 30-second why it matters. So this was somebody who, for any listeners who remember or have read about Huey Long, the old Louisiana governor who was eventually assassinated in the New Deal era, Bo Xilai was essentially China's Huey Long, of a populist figure who also was a kind of his own little kingpin. And he had been very much on the rise. He'd been assumed to get one of these seven crucial roles in the new government that's being formed later this year. And then it became, and he also was sort of a representative of, in some ways, kind of old Maoist rhetoric of returning to our red roots. At the same time, he was having this whole business empire on the side, which his wife was running, and his son was this kind of playboy student at Harvard and at Oxford, driving fancy sports cars. And as he has been exposed and brought down in a murder case too bizarre to go into, the two main implications are, first, what this shows about the level of corruption generally, and second, what it shows about the situation of governance, if this kind of person was so close to having a really major governing role, and how hard it is to have now be the case that the world's most populous country is really the only one where people have no vote for their national leadership. And so that's the Bo Xilai case.
And that's James Fallows, our guest today on Radio Times. He's a national correspondent for The Atlantic. He also happens to be an instrument-rated private pilot, and he's a regular on NPR's All Things Considered on the weekends, and he's the author of a new book, which we are talking about, called China Airborne, talking about China, what life is like inside of China, and certainly talking about U.S.-China relations. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-9499. W-H-Y-Y. Let me get some callers in. We have, it looks like, Doug from Ambler joining us on Radio Times. And, excuse me, Doug, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi. I heard on NPR a curious story that Mr. Chen received his passport from U.S. diplomats at the airport. And then about an hour later, I heard another report that the Chinese had delivered his passport to him. And then I never heard anything more about it. I thought it would be very interesting story if the first story was true, that the passport came through the U.S. diplomats.
Well, Douglas, see if James Fallows can shed some light on that. Thanks for calling in. Jim, go ahead.
Yes, that is one of many, many, many details about this case that where there are contradictory reports, and I don't think anybody will know for a while. And it's possible, you know, obviously, Mr. Chen, as a Chinese citizen, there would be a Chinese passport on which he was traveling, but which the American officials would have had to handle to put a U.S. visa in it. So it would be plausible, it would be conceivable that its last handling could have come either from the Chinese or from the U.S. side. The Chinese government was retaining it and not letting him out, but the U.S. government would have had to handle it to put a visa in it. So this is one of a very, very long skein of still hazy details.
Thanks for calling in, Doug. I'm curious, Jim, do you think he will, I mean, it's hard to know what he is thinking, Mr. Chen, go back to China? Is it good riddance as far as China's concerned? What do you think his fate and future is?
It's the first point to make, of course, is that it's impossible to know, and he's been through huge trauma for years and years. Second, under current conditions, certainly what the Chinese government would prefer is he just never come back, because the longer he's out of the country, the less he's able to do what was his main mission before, which was to serve as a rallying point for other Chinese people. As I was saying before, not to overthrow the government, but to say the government should obey its own rules and aspire to its own ideals, etc. Whether conditions loosen up enough in China to have that be different after a couple of years, I think no one can say. How he fares in a whole different language environment in the U.S. Again, it's worth remembering that since he can't see, the process of learning English will be a different one from other people. One other point that I think is very important. We tend to discuss the Chinese government as one monolithic thing that is either cracking down or loosening up, and it's worth realizing that there are internal struggles every day on how loose or tight to be, and even that dramatic first day of the Chen Guangcheng drama, where it seemed as if a deal had been struck and then it was revoked, it probably was the case that one part of the Chinese government said, okay, we'll make a deal, and then the security official said, oh, no, we have to crack down and make an example. So the fact that this is being contested day after day within the Chinese government and will be for months and years to come is important.
Let me get Peggy from Marlton to join us. And Peggy, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
You're welcome.
Last week when you talked to Paul Krugman, he was talking about the fact that when we buy something at Walmart and we complain because it's made in China, most of the money is staying here in the United States. But it made me think about the working conditions that we were recently exposed to in China, and I'm wondering if the Walmarts of the world can or should be doing more to affect the working conditions in China.
It's a good question, Peggy.
Yes.
Jim, go ahead.
Yes, that's an excellent question, I will take pride in being a person who's done a lot of the firsthand reporting on the point that Paul Krugman was making, that most of the value when you buy a Chinese-made product, only about a tenth of the value stays in China. Most of it goes to retailers in the U.S., brand-name companies from Apple to Walmart or whatever. On the working conditions, it's simultaneously true that Apple in particular needed to do more about its factories and is being under proper pressure now to do more, and that those factories are among the best in China. the scandal of factory life in China is not Apple's factories, but the non-international factories. And I think that Walmart actually is doing something laudable for which it deserves more credit, in that both in the working conditions category and also in the very, very important environmental standards category, it is using its huge supply chain in China as leverage to try to bring up the conditions in China in general. Walmart, for the last couple of years, has been working with the Environmental Defense Fund to find ways to have its huge number of supply chain factories in China have fewer emissions, less waste, less toxic horrors, et cetera. So too with working conditions. So I think that it's worth recognizing that these Western countries are very, very important levers. They're better than the Chinese norm, both environmental and in safety ways, but they need to be leading forces even more than they are.
Peggy, thanks for the call to Radio Times. Jim, what have been the consequences of China's one-child policy?
They have been... It has a number of distorting effects. The most obvious distortion is that if you walk down a street in a Chinese city, you'll typically see four grandparents, two parents, and one little jewel-like child. And that child gets a lot of attention.
Uh-huh.
But it means that for the retirement system, for example, China is, the cliche is, it's the only country ever to have gotten old before it gets rich. So there's a huge distortion that way. There's the gender distortion. For reasons that are both innocent and not innocent, there's a huge imbalance of male to female births. This has some immigration consequences. Some women are coming in from neighboring countries. It has sociological consequences. There are psychological consequences, too, when you have a generation of people all raised as single children. However, my judgment is that most people in China I've met, they are uncomfortable with some of the consequences, but they view those as preferable to not solving the population problem.
Hmm.
So I don't find many people in China who object to the policy in general. They object to specific parts of it, but they recognize that the force of numbers in China was such that they would have even worse problems if they hadn't gone down this road.
But are you saying it's a nation of spoiled brats?
A lot of Chinese people say that.
Really?
Yes. There's some of the so-called little emperor phenomenon, and there are even whole books and TV programs about what happens when two single children get married, when they've both been coddled and so. You do find now if two single children get married, they're often allowed to have two children. And there's various loosenings of the one-child policy now in rural areas and for certain ethnic groups. So people recognize it as one part of spoiled kids today. And also spoiled women in particular, because the market forces are so much in favor of women. They each can have, you know, many more suitors, so the dynamics favor them.
Well, that's fascinating. Let's take another short break. We'll get back to our conversation. We are talking about China with our guest, James Fallows. He lived in China for a couple of years with his family, and he's the author of a new book called China Airborne. We're also taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Much more to talk about after this very short break. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
The Cooper Heart Valve Center supports WHYY. Aortic valve stenosis affects nearly 300,000 people annually. Cooper is the first hospital in South Jersey offering a new non-surgical valve repair, the Sapien Heart Valve. This FDA-approved technology offers a treatment option for patients unable to undergo valve surgery and is expected to transform the treatment of aortic valve disease. More at 800-8-COOPER or cooperhealth.org/sapien.
In his new book, DNA USA, geneticist Brian Sykes acknowledges genealogy is big business in America. More of us crave information about our past. And of course, now we can create genetic portraits of who we are. On the next Voices in the Family with Dan Gottlieb, Sykes and others discuss our thirst for connection and identity. Today at noon, here on WHYY-FM.
Philadelphia Theater Company supports WHYY and welcomes Reasons to Be Pretty from playwright Neil LaBute, writer of In the Company of Men and The Shape of Things. a hopelessly romantic comedy about the hopelessness of romance. Reasons to Be Pretty looks at America's beauty obsession through the eyes of two young couples with razor-sharp wit and unexpected insight. Reasons to Be Pretty, May 25th through June 24th at the Suzanne Roberts Theater. Tickets 215-985-0420 or philadelphiatheatercompany.org.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne talking with James Fallows about China and his new book called China Airborne. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. Jim, a caller who couldn't stay on the line wants to know, why does China want to buy up our debt?
The reason is they need to do something with their money. So if they have, and here's a short answer to a very tangled situation. Over the last 10 years especially, the Chinese officials have wanted to keep the boom in low-wage manufacturing jobs going on so there'll be work for these people coming in from the countryside. To do that, it's been advantageous to them to keep the value of the currency down. To simplify, when they earn, say, $100 for selling a product in Walmart or someplace else, if they can keep the pressure on their own currency to a minimum by leaving 50 of those dollars in some kind of U.S. investment, leaving it in the stock market, leaving it in treasury bonds. This is primarily a way for Chinese officials to manage their own industrial circumstance. So they sell something for $100 in Walmart, they get $50, they bring $50 back home to China, 50 they leave in the United States, they have to invest it somewhere. They view treasury notes as the safest aspect. There is a sort of side benefit from their point of view in long-run sort of strategic leverage in the U.S., but it's mainly portfolio management. They have to do something with the money. They view it as the safest thing.
I'm wondering, though, you're describing this building boom, airports, roads, railroads in China, and more contacts with the outside world. I'm assuming the standard of living is going up for some Chinese. You're getting a more educated population, a more urbanized population. Can the government exert the same kind of control over that kind of Chinese population as they have in the past?
Well, this is, again, one other facet of the transition drama that's going on now. In the last 30 years, China has sort of gone through 19th and early 20th century modernization. The question is sort of late 20th and early 21st century modernization. Is that going to work in the current governmental structure? And that really is that is the question I'm trying to address in this China Airborne. I'll give you an illustration. For a country to become really rich, there's a certain kind of industry that it needs to foster and attract, and these often are sort of spun off from very high-end world universities. To be able to have really leading universities in the world, one proxy is, do the best scholars, wherever they might happen to be, in France and Canada, in Uruguay, in the United States, want to come to where you are and do their research there? There are a couple of real impediments the Chinese system creates now. The pollution of its cities is one surprisingly important handicap, and the limits on the Internet. Nice. If you use the Internet in China, it's really slow, and it's slow because it's censored. And so even if you can eventually find what you want, having an Internet that works essentially on dial-up speeds from the 1980s is something that can in a sense, lobotomize a society. And so that's the kind of struggle that's going on inside China now between the people who say, we have to loosen up if we want to compete with the Googles, with the Boeings, or the GEs, and the people who say, no, we can't afford to have any loosening. That drama is being played out as we speak.
And who do you think will win that drama?
It's anybody who knew the answer to that would be both extremely wise and able to make sort of sounds. A lot of the world's stakes depend on that answer, and I don't know anybody who has spent any serious time in China who can be certain about the outcome, and that's why it's so important.
You write about soft power, you know, as we think of it, hard power being more military power, and the fact that China has been building roads in countries in Africa, they are investing in Afghanistan and in mining parts of Afghanistan. What does that tell us about how China views its status in the world?
It's underscores an underappreciated difference between U.S. and Chinese power that I think Americans often have a hard time keeping sight of. You know, we see this juggernaut in China and all the extra money and resources that it has spun off, and we know that for the British in their time and for the U.S. now, having all this surplus dough has been a very important component in strength. But so far, it's not been able to do more for, it has not managed really to buy loyalty for most of the Chinese state in these soft power enterprises. For example, if there are new roads in Africa or the Caribbean or Latin America where they're putting a lot of these resources, it can in a way embitter some of the locals if they don't felt they don't feel dealt in the purest way. Americans are both noble and ridiculous because of our view that, in theory, everybody could become American. And we recognize that we have a sort of missionary overreach in thinking everybody should like our way of life. That is really foolish, but also it's idealistic in thinking that we can embrace people. The Chinese model so far has been more particular to China, so it's harder for it to exert this kind of power of example and power of inclusion in the rest of the world.
Let me get Laura from Newark, Delaware, to join us. And Laura, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hello. I work at an institution that trains Chinese students to speak English. They're mostly high school graduates who want to go to the university in the United States. This is only one institution of hundreds here in the United States, and I wonder what the impact will be when these students graduate from college and go back to China.
It's an interesting question. Jim, your thoughts?
Yes, it's very important. I should also say that Newark, Delaware was almost my hometown.
Oh,
my dad
right?
got out of the Navy, had to choose between Newark, Delaware and Redlands, California to join a medical practice. So I grew up in Southern California, but I often think about the path not taken in Newark. I think the enterprise you're involved in is of really first order importance, because at a basic level, many people in China recognize they have to learn English to interact with the rest of the world. One of the tests that every Chinese university applicant has to go through to enter a Chinese university is some kind of English test. Beyond that, the exposure of Chinese people to life outside their own country really has mattered. You can see that it just gives them a different idea of the realities of American life, of the possibilities for China in the future, different ways of organizing people. And I think that what you are doing is hugely valuable. I think the impact is almost all positive. It would become negative if overall Chinese people had a bad experience in the U.S., and some of them do, but overall most of them have a good experience and go back thinking, you know, this is a relationship to maintain, and aware of the individual difference in vitality of American culture. So I'm glad you're doing this, and I hope more and more people do it, and also that more young Americans go to China, too.
Laura, thanks for calling into Radio Times. Let's see what Jim from Flower Town has to say. And Jim, go ahead. You're on the air.
Good morning, sir.
Good morning.
Yeah, I'm also a pilot in the U.S., and I heard you mention that your guest is an instrument-rated private pilot.
Yes.
And I wonder if he'd like to mention some comparisons of aviation in the U.S. and general aviation, if it exists in China.
Well, I'm sure he would, because the book begins on that very point. Go ahead, Jim.
Yes, and if you're at Flower Town, you must be up right near Wings Field, where I've flown many a time. That's a great area. So this, in a way, that the Chinese drive to catch up with the U.S. in aviation is a distillation of some differences in the development model between China and the U.S. The U.S. has the world's most diversified aviation system because it grew up from different bases. We had, of course, the Wright brothers and all the early entrepreneurs. We had the military as an early customer for the Wright brothers. We had the post office getting into business with airmail. We had early commercial airlines. We have 5,000 airports of various size scattered across the country. We have a whole diverse network of institutions and individuals who have incorporated the air travel into their lives. In China, aviation has been from day one a military proposition. Mm-hmm. And during the Mao era, they located the main factories in the center of the country, essentially the counterpart of Nebraska, to protect them maximally from foreign bombing. Airspace in China is almost all military controlled. And so the drama for China as its business people aspire to have helicopters so they can go from one factory to another, and as its airlines try to expand so they can connect the country and satisfy the traffic, and as new navigation systems are put in, the drama is between the military, which now controls almost all the airspace, and the business forces in China, which want more and more of this to sort of catch up with the rest of the world. And that is a microcosm of all the other struggles going on in China. But right now, they are far behind and very, very rapidly trying to catch up.
You talk about Zhuhai, the air show at
yes.
Zhuhai. Describe it for us.
Yes, well, I start this book with a tale of one very exciting, to put it mildly, flight I took as a ferry pilot myself of a yes. small Cirrus plane down to the Zhuhai Air Show. Zhuhai, in one way, shows the excesses of the Chinese system. It's a huge, huge airport, an 11,000-foot runway that gets maybe one or two commercial flights a day. But every 2 years, they have a huge international air show there when the tarmac is just covered with big planes, small planes, and people doing business. And it's one of several such shows in China. And what it indicates is how the center of the aviation market is moving to China, with these 100 airports under construction, with thousands of airliners that are going to be bought in China in the next few years, and with the Chinese ambitions to build a Boeing-type plane, a sort of Gulfstream-type plane. They now own the Cirrus company of Duluth, Minnesota, which is a leading manufacturer of small planes. So it's an all-fronts ambition.
I saw a picture that I guess you took. You were flying somewhere and waiting for fuel. And I guess when the fuel arrived, there's a picture of a young man, sucking on the fuel hose.
Yes.
What's going on?
Well, this was when I was flying this plane both in Japan and China to illustrate the difference between the two countries. In Japan, the same plane was fueled in the airport by two people wearing perfectly matched uniforms with safety checklists on their chest. They bowed to the airplane after they did the fueling. They had a protective cuff around the fuel vent. In China, this same plane, we had a barrel of old siphoned fuel from some Russian trainers, and a hapless guy had to suck it out of the barrel with a plastic hose and sort of siphon it into the wing tanks on the airplane. The moral here is that in Japan there is the way to do things, and they do it very well, but in China people figure out a way to do things, even if it's not the way you would have expected, and things do get done.
You, interestingly, take your family or have taken your family to live in a variety of different countries. And I'm assuming it's instead of the sort of flybys that a lot of journalists do, you want to live there and soak in the culture.
Yeah, I have felt very very fortunate in my life with the Atlantic over these decades now that we have been able to live for long periods of time in Japan when our kids were little, and Malaysia also when our kids were little, and now recently in China. Our children are now on their own, so it was just my wife and me, although our kids came to visit. But it is a great luxury to be able to be someplace for a while and say, here is what you don't know if you are not here for some time. And that's more or less the theme of what I've written in The Atlantic and in books.
Is it also to give you a unique vantage point to look at the United States from halfway around the world in this case?
Yes. It's a way to get out of Washington, D.C.
Yes.
In the short run.
All for that.
And it is true that since I first went to graduate school in England back in the 1970s, I have my recurring theme has been compare and contrast of the U.S. with other parts of the world. And my American nationalism, I think, has only increased as the time has gone on. I've recognized how much, in my essence, I am an American. But it also makes you aware of the things the U.S. does well and the things that it doesn't do well. And I think some of the areas where it is behind and people don't realize that. I mean, just to give one other point, when I was when I first went to Europe in the 1970s, in all the creature comforts, the U.S. was just clearly ahead. Now, if you go to much of Western Europe or Australia, where I go frequently, the U.S. is behind many of those ways, and that's worth being reminded of when you travel.
And do you miss China? Are there things about China you miss?
I miss the excitement of it, and which is why 3 days from now I'll be there again.
Oh, is that right?
I'll be back in China, in Shanghai, for a relatively quick trip.
Well, let me end on a serious question. This is about, where the Jasmine Revolution, as it's called, where does that stand today?
It stands in sort of contained form. Last year when I was living in Beijing again, the Arab Spring was sort of replicated in China with a very short-lived Jasmine Revolution. The authorities took no chances whatsoever and just cracked down, not brutally, but systematically. There was very little violence, but people were arrested, cell phone networks were turned off, et cetera, and I think that very quickly a lid was put on that. So the larger question for China, the longer-term one, is essentially about the ongoing legitimacy of the system. Most people in the country feel the system has worked more than it has failed, but there are all these things, these sources of discontent. That's one reason why they have to keep the growth going so quickly, because that's what earns it its support from most of the public.
And unfair question, 30 seconds or less, what do you love about flying? Or piloting your own
plane? That you see the world in a way that is impossible except from the altitude of a couple thousand feet in a small plane, and it just is a way to distract myself from any other preoccupations and concerns. People who've done this will know what I mean. It just is an exhilarating way to see the world. It's why, since the days of Icarus, people have dreamed of flight.
Well, that's a perfect way to end our conversation. James Fallows, thank you so much for joining us today in Radio Times.
My pleasure. Thank you, Marty.
You're very welcome. He's a national correspondent for The Atlantic, an instrument-rated private pilot, and appears regularly on NPR's Weekend All Things Considered. And he's the author of a new book called China Airborne. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes to find out much more about this program. I'm Marty Moscowen. Stay with us. We'll be right back.